Good evening. I must admit at the outset that I normally don't work from a prepared text, and I'm reminded why, because I almost began my remarks by telling you that it's my distinct honor to welcome you to the 2008 awarding of the Priestley Award. In fact, I want to welcome you to the Priestley Award celebration for the year 2008. In point of fact, the award is 57 years old, not 2008, but old enough. Indeed, since 1952, we've gathered to present this award to a distinguished scientist in memory of Joseph Priestley, the discoverer of oxygen and an early friend of Dickinson College. The presentation of this award gives us the occasion to commemorate Dickinson's revolutionary heritage, and it also symbolizes our strong commitment to the advancement of sciences as integral and central focus of the liberal arts curriculum, a commitment that we have reconfirmed recently with the completion of a new state-of-the-art science building, as many of you know. Our founder, Dr. Benjamin Rush, was a true revolutionary in many aspects of his life. Rush was not only a leader in the fight for American independence, but he also championed causes such as the abolition of slavery, the education of women, and care for the mentally challenged. Rush was equally forward-looking in his thoughts on education and his vision for the college. To Rush, a broadly educated citizenry was absolutely essential to the success of the new republic. Dickinson students were, however, to receive an education that was markedly different from that offered in Europe at the time. The new nation demanded a new approach to education, and Dickinson was founded with the express purpose of developing such a distinctively American approach. A Dickinson liberal arts education, according to Rush, was to be appropriately rigorous, but ultimately useful, since Dickinson graduates were to become the citizens and leaders who would build the political and economic foundations of a new democracy. The curriculum would encourage students to make connections among diverse disciplines and to push actively at the frontiers of knowledge. As the country's foremost physician, Rush instinctively knew the role that scientific discovery and knowledge would play in shaping the new nation, and he, in fact, expected science to play a central organizing role in the Dickinson curriculum. It was the sciences, Rush firmly believed, that would help students most readily connect to emerging knowledge. It was the sciences that would ultimately realign to create new fields of thought that crossed and merged existing disciplines. It should come as no surprise that Dr. Rush actively sought out other revolutionary thinkers of the day, one of whom was, of course, Joseph Priestley. Priestley had been born near Leeds, England in 1733. Although he prepared for a career in the ministry, he had a deep and active fascination with science. After meeting Benjamin Franklin in London, for example, Priestley conducted a series of experiments on electricity. Later, he turned to investigations of what he termed different types of air, explorations that led to the discovery of sulfur dioxide, ammonia, and a gas later named oxygen. Priestley's increasingly unorthodox views on theology, coupled with his sympathy for the French Revolution and his outspoken opposition to the English slave trade, these things ultimately forced him to flee to America in 1794, actually after a mob burned down his house in England. Already well known for his scientific accomplishments, it was only a matter of time before Priestley would form close relationships and friendships with the new nation's foremost physician, Benjamin Rush. Rush's letters contain numerous references to his delightful dinners and encounters with his new acquaintance, Joseph Priestley. Priestley was every bit as dedicated to improving the condition of humankind as Rush, even visiting Rush in Philadelphia at the height of the yellow fever epidemic, where Rush had remained to attend to the urban poor afflicted with the disease. Although Dr. Priestley died only 10 years after arriving in America, his relationship with Rush and his connection to Dickinson College continued when his friend Thomas Cooper was appointed our very first professor of natural philosophy and chemistry in 1811, that appointment with the strong support of Benjamin Rush. Cooper left a lasting legacy by arranging for the acquisition of much of Priestley's scientific apparatus, thus ensuring that Dickinson students would have state-of-the-art scientific equipment with which to work, learn, and advance society. And I would say parenthetically that this equipment is still in the lower level of our library, and it's a wonderful juxtaposition in my mind between the Priestley equipment, which was the most advanced technology in the 18th and early 19th century, and then the Information Commons, which has, of course, current technology just across the hall. It's a wonderful place to be and look and think about that. The Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley honors a distinguished scientist for discoveries that contribute to the betterment of humankind. This occasion is indeed a celebration. It is a celebration of Dickinson's historic legacy and its strong commitment to scientific education and advancement. And it's a celebration of scientific achievement, creativity, and vision that is carried on in the Priestley tradition by those distinguished individuals who are selected to receive this prestigious award. It is therefore entirely appropriate that we honor this year's recipient, Dr. Joseph Taylor, for his pioneering work in the field of physics and astronomy. In order to tell you more about him and that work, I'm pleased to invite to the podium our Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy and Chair of the Department of Physics and Astronomy, David Jackson.
Thank you, Neil. It is truly an honor and a great pleasure to introduce this year's recipient of the Joseph Priestley Award, Professor Joseph H. Taylor. We are recognizing Professor Taylor for his role in the discovery of the first binary pulsar system and its unprecedented value in testing Einstein's theory of general relativity. Professor Taylor was born just a few hours from here in Philadelphia. As a boy, he developed an avid interest in amateur radio and spent a lot of time with his brother erecting rotating ham radio antennas on the roof of his parents' house. To this day, Joe Taylor is well known in the amateur radio weak signal community as the author of WSJT, Weak Signal Joe Taylor, a software package and protocol suite that is useful for passing messages via such methods as moon bounce and meteor scatter. In 1963, Professor Taylor received a BA in physics with honors from Haverford College, a liberal arts institution not unlike Dickinson. Making use of his interest in amateur radio, his honors project consisted of building a working radio telescope. This experience led him to focus on radio astronomy for his graduate studies at Harvard University, where he obtained his PhD in 1968. In 1974, while a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Taylor and his student Russell Hulse discovered the first binary pulsar system using the 300-meter telescope at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. In 1978, Taylor and his colleagues published the first report comparing the change in orbital period of this system due to gravitational radiation to the predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity. In 1980, Professor Taylor moved to Princeton University, where he was named the James S. McDonnell Distinguished University Professor of Physics. He has received numerous awards throughout his impressive career, including a MacArthur Fellowship, which is the so-called Genius Award, the Henry Draper Medal, the Tamala Prize, the Einstein Prize, the Wolf Prize in Physics, the Nobel Prize in Physics, which he shared with Russell Hulse, and the Carl Schwarzschild Medal in 1997. Professor Taylor has held appointments at Harvard University, the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Princeton University, the Institute for Advanced Studies, Arecibo Observatory, and the Australia Telescope National Facility. He has also served in many advisory and leadership capacities, including chair of the Astrophysics Division of the American Physical Society, chair of the Astronomy Advisory Committee of the National Science Foundation, co-chair of the National Research Council's Decade Survey on Astronomy and Astrophysics, and dean of the faculty at Princeton University. In addition to this impressive array of professional accomplishments, I can't help but end on a personal note. When I was a graduate student, Professor Taylor graciously agreed to supervise the experimental portion of my qualifying exams. Although my project was certainly less important than his main research efforts, I was welcomed into the Pulsar Lab to use the computers and seek advice as necessary. During my short stint in the Pulsar Lab, I can't remember ever seeing Joe Taylor without a smile on his face. Indeed, all of my interactions with Joe were met with the welcoming smile of someone who truly enjoys what he is doing. Whether he realizes it or not, his demeanor had a rather profound effect on my decision to come to a liberal arts institution. I feel fortunate to have had such a wonderful role model at a rather critical point in my professional development. At this time, I would like to remind you all to silence cell phones and other electronic devices. There will be a question and answer session following tonight's lecture, and I ask that you please wait for a microphone before asking a question so that everyone can hear you. And now, I'd like you to please join me in welcoming the 2008 recipient of the Joseph Priestley Award, Professor Joseph H. Taylor.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here on the Dickinson campus, and a great honor to be honored by you in this way tonight. A very good way to begin, I think, after the things that David Jackson has just said, is to remark on the fact that there are many other teachers in the room. I've been one most of my adult life. We often don't know the impact that we may have on some students that we've interacted with, and it was very kind of you to remember those days that we did have some brief interactions at Princeton. My goal this evening is to give you a little bit of the flavor of an astrophysical experiment which is at the base of the honor that you bring to me this evening in a somewhat distant way, and certainly of the other recognitions that David just outlined for you that I've received over the years. I have had the very great enjoyment and great pleasure of working on an experiment that is, although it has not been a fundamentally large fraction of the effort that I've put into physics and astrophysics research over the years, it's been a problem that I have worked on continually now for somewhat over 30 years, and it has brought an immense amount of enjoyment, to say nothing of the contributions that it's made to science. I want to do this, to give you this flavor of that experiment, and by doing so, begin by putting it into some historical context in a way that I hope will pay some honor in turn to the man for whom this lecture is named, Joseph Priestley, by putting it into some historical context. So I'm going to go rather quickly through some historical background, some of which has more to do than other parts of it with the specific astrophysics experiment I'm going to talk about. But it helps all of it, I think, to give you some feeling, some recapitulation for what you already know about how the scientific method works, how practical experience and explicit experimentation and observation of nature and her ways goes together with and strengthens, in turn, our understanding of nature in the form of theories that we can put forward to attempt to explain how nature works. The language of these theories, and at least in the physical sciences, is mostly mathematics these days, and so careful experiments often have numerical results which can be compared in great detail with the predictions of the theories, and that's one of the things that I want to remind you of in the nature of this very quick historical tour through relevant topics. So here's the overview of what I want to do. First, this little historical introduction. Then I want to tell you a little bit about these fascinating astrophysical objects known as pulsars, which are mostly observed with radio telescopes. I want to show you the radio telescope on which this particular experiment has been done with some nice pictures of this instrument in the northwestern corner of the island of Puerto Rico. And then I want to quickly take you through the nature of this binary pulsar timing experiment. It is an experiment which basically amounts to a clock comparison experiment, where one of the clocks is the spinning neutron star out there in space somewhere. We're keeping track of how many rotations and exactly where it is in the phase of its rotation, at the same time comparing that against the very best standards of atomic time here on the Earth. So to start the history, let's think about starting off with Copernicus. Almost 500 years ago, he was sort of putting together what was already known from observations from the ancient Greeks and from the highlight of Arab astronomy and what Europeans referred to as the Middle Ages, and understanding that the system made a lot of sense if we put the sun, not the earth, at the center of our local system of moving objects, the planets. Not too long after that came along Galileo, the Italian who is really the father of modern experimental science in many ways, had very significant contributions in the astronomy area as well as in fundamental physics and mechanics. Not long after that, Johann Kepler, German physicist, if you like, although those terms weren't used in those days, who recognized that there should be some actual, he very much believed in the harmony of nature and the fact that mathematics must in some way be closely connected with these things, and discovered that the observations which Copernicus and others, going all the way back to the Greeks, had made of the positions of the planets on the sky and how they vary with time could be understood if one postulated that the shapes of the orbits are ellipses and that the sun is located at one of the focal points of those ellipses, a fundamentally important discovery. Then, a bit later, Isaac Newton came along and recognized the fact that he could understand Kepler's statements about the shapes of the planetary orbits in a very a vastly more general way by positing the existence of a fundamental and universal force of gravitation. He could understand why apples fall from trees with just the same mathematics as he understood what kept the moon in orbit around the Earth or the Earth and other planets in orbit around the sun, that a universal law of gravitation exists, and somehow he could unify our understanding of all these mechanical motions with a single, simple, inverse square law force proportional to the masses of objects, a fundamentally important discovery, perhaps one of the most remarkable scientific generalizations of all time. Many people sort of recognize this progress of thinking over these few hundred years as being fundamentally the beginnings of modern science. Now, I'm going through these things from a point of view which is parochial in two senses, I think. I'm going to emphasize a bit more the new world than the old world, and I'm certainly viewing it from the point of view of a physicist primarily. One of the very first New World scientists, of course, is our friend Benjamin Franklin, who spent most of his life not far from here, and who made immense contributions, of course, in many different areas, statesmanship and international relations and the beginning of a new republic among them. But he was an amazing scientist for his day. And much of the early work, of course, on electricity is owing to him. Now, at a not much later time, our hero, Joseph Priestley, was doing remarkable things himself in a somewhat different area, but with a very wide range, again, of interests, of writings, of influence on other thinking of the time. As you've already heard from what Neil Weissman said, his thinking was sufficiently new and different and against, in some ways, local thinking, that he ended up having to move across the ocean to avoid some political problems at home. But he certainly made immense contributions to thinking of many kinds, politics. He was a friend of the new republics, both in France and here, and certainly was very much in sympathy with the notion of new ways of educating our young, consistent with the thinking about those same topics that gave rise to the foundation of this institution. Now, going on just a little bit further in time and back to the topics of that are closest to the experiment I'm going to tell you about, let's think about Michael Faraday in England for a few minutes. He's the discoverer of electromagnetic induction, a discoverer of the fact that there are close connections between electrical currents and magnetic influences, something which, you know, the basic ideas of electrical attractions and magnetic behavior of objects was known all the way back to the time of the ancient Greeks, but Faraday was the first one to recognize that there were connections between these two kinds of phenomena, which otherwise had been thought of quite independently. At the same time, more or less, Joseph Henry, right here in the young United States, the very first professor of natural philosophy, as it would have been called then, at my institution, Princeton, also was dabbling in electromagnetism, recognized that there were close connections between these two phenomena. He made electrical magnets, electromagnets. He actually made one that was powerful enough that it could lift the platform on which he had standing 1 ton of undergraduates. A remarkable experiment to demonstrate to students the power of electricity. Now, again, these were largely experimental efforts, Faraday's and Henry's, and some theoretical thinking was also required for substantial progress to be made, and that took place. Here's another picture of Joe Henry at the Smithsonian Institution. He went on from Princeton to become the founding director of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And I wanted to remind you of, since we've been talking a little bit about useful knowledge, which was much in the thought of the founders of this institution and of Ben Franklin, this famous quotation by Queen Victoria, apparently, when she was introduced to Michael Faraday, asked him what good all this stuff was, and he basically said, as you can see, of what use is a newborn baby. We often don't know in science when we're amusing ourselves in the laboratory trying to disentangle the way nature works, what it might be good for some years hence. We don't always know, and sometimes the answer is not much, but sometimes it's an immense amount, and of course the electricity and magnetism and electrical generators and things like that that Faraday, Hertz, Faraday, Henry, and Maxwell were trying to understand better are the very foundations of our technological society today. Now, James Clerk Maxwell, a Scottish physicist, came just a little bit after Faraday and Henry and was the one that put these things together into mathematical expressions. There are four famous equations that define more or less everything that we know about electricity and magnetism. In many colleges and universities, undergraduates wear these four equations on their T-shirts. They can be written down in that small a place, and yet they have an immense implication for much of what we do in modern society. And the German physicist Heinrich Hertz, not long after Maxwell's equations were published, recognized that these equations predict the existence of electromagnetic radiation, which probably meant, Maxwell recognized, that ordinary light is one form of such radiation, but it should be possible to generate other radiation with other frequencies and wavelengths, and Hertz was the first one who was able to do that. He generated radio waves in the laboratory, was able to detect them on essentially a receiver at the other side of the laboratory, and basically is the father in that sense of modern radio communication, including television and everything else that we do in the wireless way. Most of you have in your pockets a piece of wireless equipment, probably, and that all traces back to this time. Now, I guess I'll go just one further, and this famous face will be recognizable to all of you. There's a couple of pictures there, one in his early years in the 1920s and another one later while he was at Princeton in his later life. Einstein was another one who recognized that it had been a very useful guiding principle for hundreds of years to look for ways in which our precise understanding of the laws of nature can be simplified and unified when we recognize ways in which things like gravitation apply to not only things on the earth but also things in the sky, how electricity and magnetism are related and can be combined into one set of understanding. And Einstein's relativity was another way of doing that same kind of unification of our understanding of nature's laws. It's been a very useful guiding principle for a long time. We sort of assume by default that it probably will be a guiding principle useful still in the future, and that's why people have been working hard in recent years to look for ways in which quantum physics and gravitational physics can be understood within the same framework, because that has not yet been achieved. That's part of what all the fuss about string theory is about. And it will be very interesting to see whether that effort turns out to be on the right track or not. Perhaps it won't be, but at present we still are working under the supposition that it may well be. Now let's get on to this experiment. For that, we've got to get an astronomical flavor going here. That pretty object in the sky, as some of you will know in the room, is known as the Crab Nebula, I guess because it roughly has the shape of a crab. It's a bright, shining object left over after a star exploded in that position in the sky about 1,000 years ago, in the year 1054. That was the Dark Ages in Europe, and there's no records of this having been seen in Europe, although it should have been visible to the naked eye, and indeed, there are good records of its having been observed in China, in Vietnam, in Korea. So basically, the Far Eastern people that were looking at the sky were much better scientists than those in Europe at those days. At least they made good records of what they saw. Now, in the middle of that object, you see two stars. One of those objects is a pulsar. It is a rapidly rotating object made of nuclear matter, not atomic matter, that is the empty spaces in the atoms between the clouds of electrons and the nuclei at the centers have been crushed out of existence by the very strong forces of gravity, leaving a very dense object spinning rapidly, strongly magnetized, and generating electromagnetic radiation, because when you spin a magnet, that's what it will do, among other things. And it will generate, it turns out, beams of radio noise that go outward from the spinning object, rather the way I've tried to indicate in that sort of cartoon-like picture. The neutron star has a mass typically about 1.4 times the mass of the sun. Its radius is only 10 kilometers. It would fit within Greater Carlisle, basically, just a little bit bigger than your town. And it's got this very strong magnetic field on this scale. The Earth's magnetic field is vastly smaller than that. It's around 10 to the minus 4 Teslas. So these are huge magnetic fields. For many purposes, you get a better feeling for what a pulsar is like by listening to one instead of me talking to you about it. So let me play the couple of sound clips I have on here. There are three different pulsars. They rotate at different speeds. You get a blip of noise each time it goes around. This one is spinning about every 7/10 of a second. And the timing is very precisely maintained, so that if we do accurate timing observations at a radio telescope, we can keep track of those rotations very precisely. They're just as good as the ticks of a very accurate clock. Here's one spinning a bit faster, about 11 times per second. Things like that. Okay. You notice occasionally what seems like a little syncopation. It's not quite even, but what you're hearing is variations in the intensity of the pulses, not in the spacing of them. The spacing is very accurately maintained. Every time the thing makes one rotation, you get one blip as that beam sweeps across the Earth. Of course, it may well be true that there are other pulsars in the sky that we cannot observe because their beam never quite points in our direction. So we believe there are more of these objects out there than have actually been found. The last object I have on here in audio tape is, for many years, was the fastest rotating pulsar known. It spins 642 times per second. So what you hear is a high-pitched tone. Sounds like this. Okay. There's no point in playing any longer. That's what it sounds like. It's not going to be any different. Someone remarked once that if you could get a shaft into that and a pulley and somehow have the other end of the belt at the Earth, there would be no energy crisis here. There's an immense amount of rotational kinetic energy in a spinning pulsar. Okay, from a physicist's point of view, we simplify things to just what we know or what we think is important. So a physicist's view of a pulsar is like this: a very dense object in the center, this magnetic field around it, radio noise being spun out, some particular parameters are noted here, a rotation angular velocity. This is the speed of light. This is a radius referred to as the light cylinder radius, because at that distance, because these things are spinning rapidly, at that distance, an object traveling around with the magnetic field will be spinning at the speed of light. So basically outside of that, the star can't ever any longer have any stuff moving around with it, because it would violate the principle of relativity. There are a lot of other interesting physical facts about neutron stars, but for this purpose of this talk, we can pretty much ignore those and just think of the pulsar as a very accurate clock provided for us by nature to be observed here on Earth in a way that maybe we can capitalize on and make some interesting measurements and discoveries. Now, let's get on to making the measurements. If you fly in an airplane from San Juan, Puerto Rico, the main airport on the island, to the second largest city there, Mayagüez, you fly across the island, and you may well go across this region of very rugged-looking territory. It's basically jungle, but it is also pockmarked with these depressions in the ground known as known to geologists as karsts. They are essentially cave-in regions where the heavy tropical rainfall has leached out the limestone deep underground, dissolved it, made caves, which on geological timescales may fall in on themselves and leave these natural holes in the ground. In one of those holes, there's a round object, which is the Arecibo Radio Telescope. It is built, you know, they had to build it in a hole because otherwise it would have been too much earth to move. But with that advantage, you can build this huge reflecting dish-shaped radio telescope, which you may have seen pictures of one place or another. If nowhere else, you may have seen it in the movies. There's a good James Bond flick where the James Bond chases the bad guy out on here somewhere. And that was a lot of fun. It's also in the movie Contact and various other films. Anyway, it's a 1,000-foot diameter bowl-shaped reflector that lies fixed on its back, looking straight up. And up here at the top, 400 feet up above the center, held up by the same kind of technology that's used to build suspension bridges, there are the receivers, the antenna that receives incoming radio waves from space, and a mechanism which allows you to steer the telescope to different directions, as I'll get back to in just a minute. You can walk down underneath the reflector to the valley floor below, and as you can see, it's perfectly ordinary subtropical vegetation. The surface of the antenna, which you see above you here, is made of perforated aluminum panels. It's got lots of holes in them, about an eighth of an inch in size. So the rainfall and so forth goes right through. Even a significant amount of sunlight goes through. But radio waves are reflected off it back up to the surface. here's the a close-up of the focal arrangement up in the air. You can see this large triangular structure, which is fixed in position. Then you see this kind of banana-shaped curved member, which is pivoted at the center so that it rotates around this circular track. And on the bottom of the azimuth arm, as it is called, there are a pair of mechanisms equally spaced away from the center. They move outward together in opposite directions so that they keep the whole system balanced for weight. And this one is somewhat obviously an antenna. This one is less obviously an antenna because it is enclosed in a weatherproof radome, inside of which are antennas and radio receivers and so forth. So the incoming radiation is arranged to focus on one or the other of these receiving antennas. By the way, when James Bond chased the bad guy, they came along here somewhere and then climbed down on this thing. It was, you know, good movies. It is fun, by the way, to you can take a cable car from the ground up to the platform. I'm not sure that it's cable shows here. I often take students up on the cable car after a long night observing. When we go up here and stand on the platform to watch the sun come up over in the east, you can then actually walk down again along this catwalk that goes out in this direction. I think one of the other photos here. Yeah, this looks downward from the platform. We're looking here off to the north and east. This is the Atlantic Ocean, about 15 miles away from where the observatory is inland. And, if you keep, so we're looking there to the northeast. If you go another 4,000 miles or something, you're in Spain, I guess. Okay? Here is looking up into that radome structure, inside of which are receivers and antennas. There also are some high-power radio transmitters there. This instrument is not only a passive radio astronomy receiver, but it's an active radar astronomy transmitter. It can bounce signals off the moon and off the planets all the way out to and including Saturn. So a lot of studies of the surfaces of those planets has been done remotely by bouncing radar signals off of them and measuring the parameters of the reflected signals. Here's one more picture of the instrument at night. It's quite beautiful when the lights are on it, and you can see what's going on. I've spent a lot of happy hours observing at this radio telescope. It's a great place. In 1974, pulsars had been discovered a few years before. I was a young assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts. My very first graduate student, Russell Hulse, is the man who is shown in this picture and who shared the Nobel Prize with me 19 years later. A wonderful way for a young faculty member to begin his career is to have a student and a project that worked out as well as this one did. Here Russell is keying his software into the switches of a thing that we used to call a mini computer. It's about as big as a refrigerator and weighs rather more than a refrigerator. As you can see, it had the old style magnetic tapes on it on which we recorded our data. We had programmed this thing back at Amherst, Massachusetts to be a sort of the back end of the radio astronomy receiver. It was a time when computers were, for the first time, becoming small enough that you could hope to purchase one and use it in a sort of dedicated laboratory way, and we were one of the first to do that in radio astronomy. We interfaced this computer to the radio astronomy receiver at the Arecibo telescope, and we had programmed it to record signals in such a way that it could analyze them, looking for the repetitive pulse-like signals of the ticking clock pulsars that I've already described for you a little bit. So that's what the thing looked like. You might be amused if you can just about make it out on the upper corner. Well, in the first place, the computer seems to be enclosed in plywood, and it is. In fact, that's the shipping crate that we sent it down to Puerto Rico in. We just, when we got there, we took the front covers off it and stood it up, but didn't disassemble the shipping crate. And just left. It was easier to leave it in place. And you can see some marks up here. He is counting the new pulsars as he discovers them. So he's marking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then going in with another hash mark. And so he's sort of like carving notches on his belt. We thought at the time we started this project, there were about 20-some pulsars that already had been discovered, some by our group and many by others. We thought we might be able to double that number or even more, and in fact, he ended up finding 50 pulsars, one of which was this very famous pulsar, the first one known, and for a long time the only one known, in an orbiting system. So this neutron star was orbiting around another star. That gave us the opportunity to do this thing I've been calling a clock comparison experiment, where we examine the variations in the signal caused by the motion of the pulsar. Here's a graph that was in the original paper that we published about this discovery, showing the change in the apparent frequency of the pulses, how fast they were coming. It speeds up a little bit when the pulsar is coming toward us and slows down when the pulsar is going away from us. And we could measure that very precisely, as you can see here. And the curve that is drawn through those is a curve which obeys Kepler's law, with Newton's mathematical interpretation of it. In other words, it's just the expected curve for an elliptical orbit around another object being governed by Newtonian gravity. But there was even more to it than that. Here is sort of where we were in 1974 when we had made this discovery. It became clear almost right away that we had stumbled upon not only an interesting pulsar in its own right, but upon a mechanism for doing a very precise experimental test of an aspect of Einstein's relativity theory, which had never previously been testable. So here we are on the Earth with our big telescope in Puerto Rico, and we're looking at an orbiting pair of objects, some 25,000 light years away, we estimated. We didn't know the distance very accurately then, but that's sort of halfway across our galaxy. It's a huge distance away from the solar system. We were observing this train of pulses, which varied. Sometimes they're closely spaced together, sometimes farther apart. It's exaggerated in that sketch, but that's the gist of what we were observing. And the spacing between when this whole thing repeated was only about 8 hours, just a little bit less than 8 hours. In other words, this previous slide, this thing has a cycle that is repeated after 7 3/4 hours. In other words, these orbits, one star around the other, were being completed in almost 3 orbits a day. Remarkable. This means the velocity is very high. It's moving at a mildly relativistic velocity. That means not just Newton's laws equations should apply, but also the equations of Einstein's relativity theory. When things are getting moving fast, close to the speed of light, relativity kicks in and becomes very important. And one of the predictions of relativity for a system like this is that it should gradually lose some of its energy in the form of so-called gravitational waves, a form of radiation which was predicted by Einstein when his theory was published in 1915, but which had never previously been testable, and which Einstein died in 1955 thinking probably, quite possibly, never would be testable. However, nature provided us the test bed for doing it. So what we're expecting to see is that this system should be losing some of its energy to gravitational waves. With Einstein's equations, we can calculate how much that energy loss should affect the orbit. And it turns out the orbit should be shrinking by about 1 millimeter per orbit. Now, it has been described as the ultimate in scientific chutzpah to imagine that you could measure something that is 25,000 light years away, which has an original size of about 1 million kilometers, and yet that size is going to change by 1 millimeter? Give me a break. How could that ever be measured? It turns out it can be measured, owing to the very precise clock-like behavior of the spinning neutron star. And that's what we did a quick calculation in 1974 to see whether this should be detectable. And we actually thought at the time, maybe. It was a bit beyond what we knew how to do then, but it was not so far beyond that it seemed impossible. So we set out to try to see what we could do. Now, at the time also, it was reasonable to go through the following kind of thinking. You might think, wait a minute now, you want to do this experiment in fundamental gravitational interaction to see whether it does what Einstein's theory says it should. Wouldn't it be better to design a laboratory experiment to do it where you can control everything? You know, you make a big machine that should generate gravitational waves and see if you could detect them across the room, or at least see if the energy, if the machine should lose energy at the rate that would be predicted. And that is, in fact, a very reasonable question to ask. And Einstein asked it of himself in 1916 when he realized what might happen. And this is what gave him reason to think that this might never be testable. He imagined designing a big machine, say a huge motor, where you spin a large asymmetric object, like a long steel bar, something which is not rotationally symmetric, and find out how much, do a calculation to see how much energy it should radiate. It should have a luminosity in gravitational waves given by this expression. And I won't go very much into what this equation means, except to emphasize to all of you students of physics in the room, this capital G is Newton's constant of gravitation. In the units that we all normally use, it's a very small number, 6 × 10⁻¹⁻, roughly. That's bad news to have a very small number in the numerator of the expression of something that you're trying to measure. Worse yet, this number down here is the speed of light. That's huge. And it's in the denominator, and it's raised to the 5th power. So, you know, this luminosity is going to be tiny. And if you put in some numbers for the radius of the steel bar, its length, its mass, how fast you're going to spin it, you discover that you get this minuscule amount of luminosity in gravitational waves, 10 to the negative 22. That is a decimal point, 22 zeros and a 1, ergs per second. And an erg is about the amount of energy it takes when you blink your eye. It's nothing. It's really tiny. So this just seems out of the question to do a laboratory experiment of this kind. But nature is not constrained by the sizes of things in laboratories, and if you take a couple of objects and let them orbit each other in somewhere out in space, each object has the mass of a star, roughly, and let them orbit at some reasonable speed, like that of the binary pulsar, and you discover when you put all the numbers in that in this case the luminosity and gravitational waves turns out to be a number which, for the actual binary pulsar that we discovered, these two quantities are both equal to 1, and therefore we're getting roughly 10 to the plus 31 ergs per second. This is a huge amount of energy. The total luminosity of our sun is only about 2 powers of 10 higher than that. So 1% of the total energy output of the sun should be going away in gravitational waves from a system like this. Maybe we could measure that. And indeed, it turns out that we can. Now, here, very quickly, is the sort of a block diagram of what this experiment actually looks like when we did it. We have the radio telescope, an antenna producing a signal. We bring that into a spectrometer that does appropriate things for analyzing the signal. And the output, in the end, goes into a computer that stores things. Then a bunch of other equipment is present, all of which has to do with the timekeeping aspects of the experiment on the ground. Remember, we're going to compare the pulsar clock against whatever best clock we can produce on the ground. And to do that, we have a so-called atomic clock at the observatory. It keeps very precise time. It's good to about 1 microsecond per day. And even that, we thought, wasn't necessarily going to be quite good enough. But fortunately, at about the time we were starting this experiment, the GPS satellites were starting to be launched, and we could actually transfer time to Arecibo from a distant national timekeeping laboratory, which has a lot of atomic clocks in a temperature-controlled room and things that we couldn't reproduce readily. And so we can actually keep a running total of how far off our local clock is from the very best standards of atomic time kept anywhere on Earth, such as at the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. So the observational data for this experiment are what we refer to as a large file on a computer of pulse times of arrival, or TOAs. They are the times at which we recorded a pulse from the pulsar according to our local clocks, and we're going to then analyze the data in that way. Now, the analysis can be summarized in this meat grinder that I showed here. What goes into it are the pulse times of arrival, or TOAs, at the observatory. That's what topocentric means. But we have to account for the fact that the observatory is moving. The Earth, after all, is spinning on its axis and moving around the sun, and the moon perturbs it a bit. All those things have to be put in. That is done by means of a very precise, relativistically accurate model of the solar system, which has been developed over the years. It's based on astronomical data all the way back into Kepler's time, but is most heavily influenced by recent astronomical data, including the radar astronomy information that I was talking about a few minutes ago. That model of the solar system is maintained by the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory these days because they need it in order to get from here to Mars and other places they want to go with very precise accuracy. So they need this very precise model of exactly where all the objects in the solar system will be at any given time. So we need to use that. We need to put in these clock corrections between our local clock and the best clock. Interestingly, we have to put in some adjustments for the fact that the Earth spinning on its axis does not quite spin at a constant rate. Why not? Well, after all, the Earth is not a rigid sphere. It's got oceans and atmosphere sloshing around. It's got a molten core. And so the length of the day is not quite constant. That's why every few years you may remember that we have a leap second, 1 second at the end of a calendar year or sometimes in the middle of a calendar year on June 30th will be added to the time because the Earth has slowed down a little bit from where it would have been if it had kept the time kept by our standard of definition of what a second is. So that has to be put in. If we didn't put that in, we would have misadjusted for the exact position of the observatory as it moves around with the Earth's rotation. All of those then go into a computer code, which I've written and developed over the years. It's now widely used for many other pulsar experiments, done by my group as well as many others. And out of it come a series of the interesting results, the so-called model parameters for this spinning pulsar. That's what we're aiming to measure. Now, I'm not going to spend any time on these equations, but I will show you that what we observe can be related to some fundamental properties of the pulsar and the object about which it rotates. And these parameters on the left-hand side of these five equations are things that we can measure directly from the process I've just described to you. We get numbers for those things. And on the right-hand sides of these expressions are a number of parameters. M1 is the mass of the pulsar. M2 is the mass of the other thing that it's orbiting around. Capital M is the sum of those two masses. This PB is the period of the binary system. That's the 7 3/4 hours that it takes one to go around the other. That number changes a little bit with time. E is the eccentricity of the orbital ellipse. If E is equal to 0, it's a circle. If E gets close to 1, it's a very long, thin ellipse. So those things all get in. Each one of these equations depends upon the unknown masses of the two stars, M1 and M2, in a different way. And the next slide graphically shows you how those well-measured parameters depend upon the pulsar mass and the mass of the other star, which at the beginning, because we didn't build this apparatus, we would not have known. So we have to measure them first and then see if everything else works out the way Einstein predicts that it should. So the test, the experimental test that we want to do is to see that when we implement curves on this diagram, which illustrate the measured values of each one of these measurable parameters, omega dot, PB dot, R, S, gamma, all those things are measured, remember, and we have equations that describe these curves, and if everything that we think we understand is behaving the way Einstein says it should, then these curves had better all intersect at a single point. And so the test in the experiment is the test to which it is true that all those curves intersect at a single point. I've indicated, as you can see, that as well as you can see in that picture, they do. Another way of expressing the same information is to take, say, two of the best measured parameters, omega dot and gamma, take the point at which they intersect, and then calculate from that what the rate of change of the orbital period should be. That's what this quantity is. And then see if that agrees with the time changes that we get in the direct clock comparison experiment. And that is illustrated, that agreement is illustrated in this final experimental slide. It shows that at the time, let's see, this is now plotting the amount by which there has been a cumulative shift in how long it took for the pulsar to get back to its point of closest approach around the other star as it moves in its elliptical orbit. As you can see, that time, according to these measured dots, has been getting a little bit earlier over time, starting from back in 1974 when we set the original parameters shortly after the discovery of the object. So the points have been getting earlier, and they have been getting earlier at a rate which accelerates with time. In other words, it's not a straight line effect. It is an accelerating effect. These two stars are coming closer together at about 1 millimeter per orbit, and this is the effect that that produces on the timing part of the experiment. The prediction of Einstein's theory is the curve that's drawn here, and as you can see, the points could hardly fall any closer to spot onto that line time after time. It always astonished us to go back after not having made an observation of this pulsar for a while. For example, particularly after this gap when the Arecibo telescope was taken off the air for some major renovations, refurbishment, when we came back again and measured it. There it is again, right on the line where it should be. There was one time when it wasn't right on the line where it should be, and we scratched our head for the best part of a day until we remembered, my God, was there a leap second on July 1st this year? And we went back and discovered that, yes, there was, and we had forgotten to put that into the program. And so this was telling us that there was something wrong. We better find it. So let me, I'm going to wind things up now. Let me summarize. Relativity predicts that gravitational interactions have to propagate at the speed of light. And that means that gravitational waves must carry energy away from an orbiting double star system like this one. If we try to describe that in Newtonian language, which is much closer to what we sort of instinctively feel about the way mechanical things work, we could say that that effect happens because each star feels the gravitational pull of the other star in the direction of that other star, but actually not quite from where the other star is, but from where it was one orbital propagation time ago, where the propagation speed of the gravitational force is taken to be, as relativity says it must be, equal to the speed of light. So that means that there's a slight angular departure. The forces between the two objects are not quite between their centers. Now, the amount by which they differ is tiny. According to relativity, it is proportional to the speed of the objects in their orbit divided by the speed of light raised to the fifth power. That's the same c to the fifth that you saw in that equation that I expressed. Now, if you put the velocity of this object over the speed of light and raise it to the fifth power, you get a number about equal to 10 to the negative 15. That would come out as an angle in radians. It's a tiny angle, a tiny fraction of a degree. It's, in fact, about equal to the angular subtents of a human hair seen at the distance of the sun. Remarkably small, but it's enough that it causes a slight perturbation in the way this orbit behaves, which accumulates over time, and it gradually builds up in its accumulation over time in just the way that this graph shows. It is, again, a remarkable consequence of this very subtle effect of Einstein's theory, which he felt was so subtle that it might never be measured. But as it turns out, we can't foresee what nature may have in store for us, and binary pulsars were never foreseen during Einstein's lifetime. It's been a great pleasure to bring you this brief overview of this experiment, which I've had so much fun working on. Thank you very much for your attention. And I would be most delighted to answer a few questions before we finish the evening's events. And I may not be able to see you well, so if you wave your hand at me or something. Anyone? Yes, please. Great. We'll bring you a microphone so that everybody can hear.
What type of object is the pulsar orbiting around?
Oh, good question. The other object is, we believe, almost certainly another neutron star, probably one that either is no longer spinning fast enough to generate radio emission, or if it is, it is spinning in such a way that the angle of its inclination such that its beam of radiation never passes over the Earth. So it might be a dead pulsar. It might be a pulsar which we're not favorably situated in space to observe. There are many reasons for believing that it must be another neutron star that is a very compact, very dense object. One of them is that, remember I told you the size of the orbit was about 1 million kilometers. That is roughly equal to the size of our sun. Other stars are comparable in size to the sun, or in some cases even a lot larger. So you basically can't put another real main ordinary star in there without them being almost touching. In that case, you would expect the pulsar to disappear when it goes around behind the other one. We don't see that. We don't see the many other effects, such as tidal effects, that would be interacting between the two. So it basically has to be a very compact object. There are evolutionary reasons. Our understanding of stellar evolution, the way stars form and evolve, for believing that, again, that this system evolved from originally two very high-mass stars, both of which went through supernova explosions and left behind spinning neutron stars. Other questions? There's one here. Up here. Thank you. Yeah, good question. No, we definitely did not have this experiment in mind. We did what we thought we would were doing was scanning the sky looking for previously unknown pulsars. This was a new phenomenon. We'd only known about them for a couple of years. There weren't very many known yet. We wanted to study how they might be distributed throughout our galaxy, whether they were concentrated along the Milky Way, the way other stars are, things like that. We wanted to see if we could tie down the birthplaces of them so that we could tie them into the picture of stellar evolution. We also thought that it would be fascinating if we did find one in an orbiting system, because we were not thinking about relativity at the time, but we were just thinking that that would give us a definite mechanism for measuring the mass of a neutron star, which is a fundamentally important number to have, and we didn't have that number yet. You asked, though, how long it took us after the discovery, after we knew what we had found, for it to be clear that this was a potentially important experiment. And the answer is not long at all. The news got around pretty quickly that what we had found, even before there was a published paper, it was the news got around by the grapevine. Theorists who had been thinking about stellar evolution problems involving neutron stars were onto it right away, were telling us you ought to measure this, you ought to measure that. And it didn't take long. One of my colleagues at the University of Massachusetts and many others wrote us. We didn't have email then, but we actually have handwritten letters that said, you know, you ought to look at this or that. And one of them particularly emphasized the value of measuring the long-term evolution of the orbital period, because it might allow us to detect the effects of gravitational waves. So I think we knew that within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks after the discovery.
Have we determined the density of a neutron star yet?
How do we determine the density?
Well, I mean, have we actually, like, determined the density of a typical neutron star?
I'm sorry, I still may not have gotten it. You were asking, how do we determine the density of the neutron star?
Oh, well, no, have we actually determined
it? Oh, have we? Density, of course, I said these are extraordinarily dense objects because they are nuclear matter without all the empty space between the electrons and the nuclei of atoms. How do we know that? Well, density is mass divided by volume, right? Mass per unit volume. So in order to find that out, we would have to know the size. There has been no direct size measurement of a neutron star. There are some slightly indirect measurements, and they all are consistent with sizes around about 10 kilometers in radius, which is the number that I gave you. Fortunately, that's the number that doesn't surprise us. It's the number that we would have expected if, as we believed was the case, these things are actually like gigantic atomic nuclei, if you like. They are atomic nuclei with an atomic number of about 10 to the 52. So, you know, ordinary atomic numbers go up to about 100. These are just huge, way beyond that. And that's what they are. Something with the density of it's about 100 trillion grams per cubic centimeter. Water has a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. A teaspoonful of neutron star matter would weigh about 1 billion tons. I once realized, thinking about it, that if I had such a teaspoonful here, or say a sugar cube size of it, and dropped it, I couldn't hold it, of course, but for the moment, let's say that I could and I dropped it, what would happen? It would go certainly through the floor, through the bottom of the building, and in fact, through the Earth. You know, all this stuff is nothing to something that weighs 1 billion tons. It would go all the way through. It would effectively go into orbit around the center of the orbit, around the center of the Earth, but the orbit is pretty much a straight line, so about 90 minutes later, it would come back up here. After having gone through the center of the Earth, it would come back up here. That's fantasy, but nuclear matter is very different from atomic matter, and that's the principal difference. Another question here? Can we have the microphone down here, because that will get it onto the tape that's being made? There we go. Thank you.
was referring to the origin of the system. It's evidently two neutron stars, but the distance between them is approximately the same as the diameter of the sun.
Right.
So if this had been two sun-like stars or slightly larger than that, they would be touching each other.
Very good question, yeah. So if anyone couldn't hear, the question was, if these things are as close together as the size of a normal star, how did they originate? If they'd originated at that spacing, the stars would have run into each other and perhaps merged as one or whatever. The answer is definitely they started out much farther apart. A orbiting system will maintain its basic size and structure as long as there are no dissipative effects, as long as only orbital energy remains as orbital energy. But if there are ways to lose energy, for example, one star raising tides on the other, causing frictional interactions. That's why the moon, incidentally, is moving gradually farther away from the Earth, because the moon raises tides on the Earth raises tides on the moon. Both of those cause friction, that it makes the orbit evolve. In that case, it makes the orbit evolve outward, but in the case of what happens with a pair of stars evolving, when they undergo rapid periods of mass loss, they shed some of the outer atmosphere as a precursor to the explosive event that we refer to as a supernova, then they lose a lot of the orbital energy in that form, and they come closer together. And you can actually do calculations that show how that should work, and it definitely can end up producing a closely spaced pair like the one that we observe. There can also be processes in that evolution of what started out as a fairly widely separated pair of high-mass stars that will break up the orbit entirely, and you end up with two stars shooting off in roughly opposite directions. That's why some stars have much higher velocities than other stars do. If they have escaped from a fast-moving binary orbit, they carry away a lot of orbital velocity with them. What, question over here, maybe? And maybe we'd better wind this up fairly soon. I know that some people have schedules and things they need to attach.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Will the gravitational waves, do you believe that will be associated with wave-particle duality, that a gravitational particle, a graviton or something may eventually be observed? Thank you.
Okay, another excellent question. The questioner is referring to the fact that we know that electromagnetic radiation in some circumstances can be treated according to its wave-like properties, things like interference and wave cancellation and that sort of thing, all behaves like waves that you can sort of picture, like water waves even. But other properties of electromagnetic radiation obey the laws of quantum mechanics, and they act like particles rather than waves, quanta of energy concentrated in one region. And there is this so-called wave-particle duality. Neither description by itself is a complete description as we now understand nature. And sometimes, in some frequency ranges, you have to treat things quantum mechanically, and in other ranges, you do not. Presumably, the same thing will turn out to be true of gravitational waves, and my guess is that if and when we have an adequate theory of quantum gravity, it will accommodate quantum mechanical phenomena that include having a graviton, the analog of a photon for ordinary light. But we have not yet made any direct measurements of quantum phenomena in gravity, and we're definitely not going to do it with this binary pulsar. This is a very classical regime where ordinary wave mechanics will certainly be the correct description in the foreseeable future. Quantum gravity may well be important in the very early universe, rapidly expanding universe, when it was very much denser, or at very small scales, and not like the binary pulsar at all. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, very much. It's been a pleasure to be with you here. Okay.
So, again, the Joseph Priestley Award is being given to Dr. Joseph H. Taylor for his discovery of the first binary pulsar and its unprecedented value in testing Einstein's theory of general relativity.
The award itself is
struck from a mold of Joseph Priestley done by Josiah Wedgwood in 1779, based on a painting of Priestley by John Flaxman in 1775. So this is Priestley three times removed and considerably smaller. But it's, I think, a very lovely reproduction and very appropriate since, as I said earlier, 1952, not for the last 2008 years, but since 1952, we've been awarding this this prize to a distinguished scientist, and I'm delighted to award it to you for your extraordinary
Thank you so much. Thank you, David. I can assure you that it is indeed an extremely handsome medal, and I encourage anyone who wants to come up and have a look at it. I'll put it on the chair in the front. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.